How does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, our behaviours, our communities, or influencing people in power, that is our question. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. I'm Grace Wilde, and in this episode, we'll be talking about Extinction Rebellion. Founded only last year, Extinction Rebellion, or XR as it's known, is now a global mass movement. XR say we are in a climate emergency, and that the authorities have failed to respond adequately. They have three demands of government. One, to tell the truth about the crisis. Two, to act now to cut greenhouse emissions to net zero by 2025. And three, to go beyond representative politics by creating a citizens' assembly to find ways to tackle the crisis. Their tactics are non-violent civil disobedience, based on other examples of social change. Think of the civil rights movement in the US or the suffragettes here in the UK. XR have flooded the streets of major cities across the world, relying on rebels who are willing to be arrested. Part of the theory is that by eating into police and court resources, governments will sit up and listen. So, what role does XR play in the wider picture of climate activism? Despite being a mass movement, is it really inclusive? How widely is XR supported by the public? And what can other changemakers learn from how quickly XR has shifted the dial? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by Chloe Corradetti from Extinction Rebellion.
Hello.
Rashid Nix, a community activist and a member of the Green Party.
Hello.
And Alistair Roxburgh from Friends of the Earth.
Hello.
So, last week we went down to speak to the activists who were claiming the streets of sites around Westminster in what is now known as the October Rebellion, and we asked them why they were there.
I climbed on top of the trailer and I used a bicycle D-lock to attach my ankles to the roof. And I've been here for 25 hours.
I was walking down the mall last night and someone was saying, it's really sad if I have children, my grandchildren, this area will be covered in water and it'll be ruined. So, like, what's the point of bringing children into the world? And isn't that such a devastating, sad thought?
I'm rebelling today for the same reason that I've been rebelling for over a year now. It's a bit of a cliche almost, but the house is truly on fire. Once you've truly grasped it and felt the full terror of what's coming and how near it is, then this is the only thing left for us to do.
I'm here rebelling today because I feel this is the last possible action that we can take. We've tried a political avenue, a legal avenue, and none of those avenues have created the changes that we need to create.
One of the most discussed aspects of XR has been whether it is inclusive. It didn't take long for our panel to get stuck into the question. Rashid, what are your initial reactions to those vox pops?
What strikes me about this movement is as much as it's claimed to be a global movement, it's not very inclusive. And so I'm listening out for voices and the cadence of people of colour's voices. And maybe there were people of colour at the protest, but I know it hasn't connected with people from my community whatsoever. And I find that really interesting. You know, we live in a planet 7.5 billion people, and the so-called minorities are actually the majority. They're the global majority. And for some reason, this whole climate change argument within the West over here, there's no connection. There's no connection. And that always surprises me.
Chloe Corradetti.
Yeah, I think in terms of the inclusiveness is something within XR in general is an imperfect organisation. And so as any kind of grassroots movement, that's definitely something which a lot of work could be done on and trying to be done on. And especially the connection with local communities is something that some people are dedicated to try to do that, but it's obviously not always successful. And I think an important point that you raised as well is in the West, we are the one that pollute the most, but it's not the one who have the effect of climate change the most striking right now.
And if there's one country on the face of planet Earth that has really suffered from the effects of climate change, it'd be Bangladesh. You know, I know guys from Bangladesh who said to me, you know, I went back home and the village that I came from doesn't exist anymore. It's underwater. So climate change is real. Now, if you imagine the largest Bangladeshi community outside of Bangladesh is in London. It's in Tower Hamlets. It's the centre of London. Yep. It's not some remote place out in the Hebrides somewhere where you can't get there. I do a lot of work with my brothers from Bangladesh, and they said, look, we're here. And XR didn't connect with him. So when XR was criticised for not being diverse, you can talk about the imperfections of the organisation, but there are, you know, it's being steered in a certain direction. That's what we're seeing. These guys are, for them, and for a lot of people I know from my community, we're like, well, you know, this whole climate change argument, it's really like a bastion of, I don't know, white privilege. As a whole, it's a very exclusive movement.
Alistair Roxburgh.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I mean, I think sort of it's not something which is, unfortunately, new to just XR. It's the environmental movements as a whole. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a conference in Bristol called Race in Nature, which was organised by Maya Rhodes, who's 17 years old, conservationist, particularly around wildlife and birds. And it was a great day, but it really highlighted the failures of sort of, I guess, the environmental movement to be inclusive and to be welcoming. I think for me, it's really important that we're listening, we're learning, and we're acting to change that as well, and that we're not passive in that and not just going, well, it's one of those things.
Critics have definitely said that XR is not doing enough to expose links, I guess, between the climate crisis and systemic racism, colonialism, systems that have exploited our planet. Do you think there are movements that, Rashid, that are operating in that way, that are built on that foundation?
Absolutely. Who does speak to the other? A lady called Susan Dalwell. And she's an activist, and she works with Indigenous communities. After spending time working with, you know, the so-called climate change groups, and she found that the spaces that they had were so unwelcoming to her as a person of colour, and the issues that she raised around how, you know, communities of colour were being ignored, how Indigenous people were being marginalised, and, for example, how, you know, some of these organisations, they get a lot of grants, they get a lot of funding. And the way that operates is that you have a kind of hierarchical structure that hasn't really changed, you know, in the past, I don't know, 500 years. And so she said that she raised these issues and she was basically thrown out of the movement, you know, because she was going to places and connecting with people and she was seeing stuff and she was raising issues that really questioned, you know, are these organisations, are they really doing what they claim to be doing, or are they using this as like a vehicle to perpetuate a system that has been here for 500 years? Now, because of things like social media, people of colour are just hooking up by themselves without these groups, without the facilitation going ahead, and we're just connecting with each other on a global level, with or without XR, with or without Friends of the Earth.
What do you think needs to sort of really change across the environmental movement to shift this fundamentally?
What needs to happen? I think the people in my community, we're down the bottom of the pyramid. We're worried about personal safety. Will my son make it home from school tonight without being attacked? People from my community who's in social housing. And right now, social housing is under attack. So your community's under attack. So you don't have time to think about, okay, well, you know, what's going to happen in 30 years' time? How many harvests do we have left before there's a complete breakdown? You're thinking, will I have a home in 6 months? So our basic needs haven't been met. So maybe some of the things that, you know, you guys on the side of the fence where you are, you have resources. What we don't have in our community is resources. And if you're serious about what it is you claim to be about, then somehow there would be a resource transfer to people of colour and BME communities. You know, those positions as the directors and the assistant directors and the communications managers, those positions that carry, you know, 60, 70, 100,000 a year, whatever your organisation is, these are occupied by middle-class white people. These ain't no black people getting these types of jobs. You know it and I know it. So if we're not even in positions within those organisations to even have a conversation over a cup of coffee about what we're going through, then how will you ever know what we're going through? There's a complete communication break.
Yeah, I think it's totally a fair point. And the climate change crisis will not be able to be changed, and the systemic change that is needed cannot be achieved without a social justice element to be brought into it. And we are all in a system right now, and we all contribute to some extent to that system. And that's also what happens when you raise up rebels. There will be some element of the system that, you know, infiltrate the organization. Right now, I know that Extinction Rebellion, we're trying to, we've got local groups in every borough, which are trying to engage with the different communities. In Hackney, for example, we did a meeting with FACE leader of the, you know, different FACE represented in Hackney. And we had a discussion on the subject of the climate crisis and tried to gauge basically exactly what you said. Like, is this a priority for you? And obviously, as you mentioned, it's not a top priority because there is other issues in the community that come first. So I think that was a good first step to have this discussion. But now we need to make the interlink how those needs might be actually part of the system that we are trying to combat. So it actually, in my opinion, could go hand to hand. And that's kind of, we're trying different methods to see how that could work. And yeah, it is totally imperfect at some point. But I think there is a real effort that is brought into systemic change means bringing the social justice on the forefront with climate change, because those two, you can't solve one and not solve the others. I think that's what is trying to be done on the non-hierarchical Extinction Rebellion way of working, is by doing it locally on those kind of scales.
It's clear from this conversation that Extinction Rebellion isn't immune to the diversity issues and power imbalances right across the social sector, which we saw highlighted by the charity So White movement earlier this year. I wondered, Alistair, what you think charities need to do about diversity and inclusion.
Straight up, it just needs to change. For organisations like Friends of the Earth and others as well, fundamentally shifting stuff and pushing stuff in terms of the structure of the organisation. And that goes right from a governance level, so sort of what do our boards look like? And the stats on sort of diversity of boards are pretty awful. Very few which are genuinely diverse and representative of the societies we live in today. So how do we structurally change our organisations to be more inclusive? Needs to be a starting point. And that needs to be done with sort of people listening very carefully, listening and learning, and then changing as well. And so giving sort of alternative ways to get involved, and particularly from Friends of the Earth's point of view, in terms of empowering communities to help shift local level things so that we are effectively tackling the climate crisis has been a part of what we've been trying to do.
You mentioned Friends of the Earth empowering communities and local communities. Are they working class communities? Are they BME communities? Because we don't see Friends of the Earth down in our community, you know? Where do you guys do the disempowering work?
I think, like many organisations, we've been sort of quite directive in our campaigning, and that wasn't doing anything to empower communities. So what we've done is we've tried to shift our model, and we've done a couple of different things, really. So one is that the resources, our website that we use now, is far less about our brand as Friends of the Earth. It's about set of resources that are available to everyone, first of all. And then looking at sort of the range of communities we work with, we've tried to broaden out my colleagues who work sort of on the ground, working with a range of different communities and groups on different issues.
Such as?
So, for example, working with communities up in Blackpool, on things like fracking around Preston New Road. We've just had a community in London start a Friends of the Earth Seek network, which is kind of a cross-capital type one, and trying to go beyond like geographical boundaries. And one of the things we've started doing is going, how can we sort of approach other communities across the country? Big organisations tend to end up in your sort of your Brightons and your Bristols quite often. So how do we work with communities in places like Hastings on the south coast, communities like ones on Teesside around Middlesbrough as well. So we're trying to do more of that, but it's still really early days.
These protests have received considerable media attention, but does that mean the general public are on board? Our panel discussed what XR had done to raise awareness of the climate crisis and who they were really reaching with this message.
I would say that XR has definitely raised a debate, definitely. To see, Question Time and Reed was on there. And I thought, you know, this is a conversation that wouldn't have been taking place unless the protesters had come out and had brought London to a stand. So for that, you got to say that, you know, XR have done what they set out to do. But at the same time, I still have my my reservations, and the conversation itself is still, you know, it's still this kind of exclusive conversation that's taking place. I'm about language that actually creates a different paradigm, and I'm not hearing the language that's creating anything new. I'm hearing the language which is kind of, you know, just rehashed. And the irony is, it's the ideas of two men of colour, really, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. which XR are sort of drawing upon. I find that there's like a sort of postmodern irony that you could take the ideas and somehow you can't take the people. And it really creates a sort of them and us situation.
I do agree that language is extremely powerful. Like people would sing stuff like "Police, we love you," which is problematic and which is something that has been raised as an issue on a people's assembly way, which is how we take decision. And we've kind of tried to, you know, tell the message that this is something that is exclusive and that we shouldn't have those kind of chance when we protest. Regarding the media, I think as an organisation we are extremely critical of the media, and we do think that they are not doing the job in raising the alarm, neither using the right language, talking about climate change instead of the climate crisis. So to kind of break down a system that we are all kind of guilty to have been participated in for so long takes a lot of stepping back and listening. And so I'm really grateful for you to share with you all of that you're saying, and that criticism is extremely important for us to learn, because as a grassroots movement, we're constantly in evolution, and to hear what you're saying and trying to obviously work on something.
You know, I know grassroots people, and they have no money, they have no resources, they have zero impact in terms of media, but they get on and they do what they do because that's what the grassroots people do. Are you really a grassroots organisation? The reason why I say that is because, you know, people that I know that are grassroots people, one of their main issues is policing. The way police would disproportionately stop and search, illegally detain, deaths in police custody. The relationship between the black community and the police historically has never been a very good relationship, you know. I've been pulled up so many times, I even forget. And I work and I pay tax, and I'm thinking, well, if I'm being detained, what happens to the young black kids who are like Greta's age, 16, 17? What are they going through? And there's no way that XR is going to connect with that population, because it's not grassroots in terms of, you know, being recognised on the ground.
I mean, I totally agree. Like, being disruptive in the way of being arrested is for the privileged one, and I think the fact that we are in this system and acknowledging this, obviously, you if you promote arrestability, you also have to acknowledge that this is something that some category of people of colour, might be suffering from daily on a completely discriminatory level. And therefore, as an issue as important that will affect many factors of life, it's really important, if you are a person who have the privilege to be able to do something about it, you know, for me it's like taking that privilege and using it in a good manner. But I don't think there is really a strong emphasis on the fact we are not asking anyone to be arrested against the voluntary, and we're also acknowledging that the police as an institution is obviously systematically kind of discriminatory.
It's not just the police. The police might be the front line, but behind the police, you know, you've got the courts, you've got the lawyers, you've got the whole system that goes behind it. And you guys got your work cut out. It's noble doing what you're doing, and people like myself will kind of, you know, we'll be at the sidelines just watching. Because, you know, the days of me being arrested for stuff that I've done and stuff that I haven't done, hopefully, inshallah, those days for me are finished.
So we haven't seen anything quite like XR in the environmental movement. So what is it that makes it different? We went out and asked people what it was about Extinction Rebellion specifically that had got them out onto the streets.
I've been quietly campaigning forever. You know, I've made all sorts of personal choices in my life to shrink my carbon footprint. But it's never going to be enough. And when Extinction Rebellion came along, it was like, I can hitch my wagon to this. This is offering me true hope. It's radical.
I think the strength of XR is that we are a non-violent organisation, and that there is this regenerative culture, which means that we're always checking in with each other and trying to make sure that everyone is having a good time and that we're all coping, because it takes a toll.
Well, I've been concerned about the environment and environmental destruction since I was very little, and then forgot about it for several years, and then actually Extinction Rebellion revitalised my concern about the big impact that human beings are having on the planet and on each other.
What Extinction Rebellion and these climate strikers, Greta Thunberg and loads of others have done is raise awareness of the reality of what we're facing, but that awareness raises anxiety. So people talk about eco-anxiety, but we should be talking about eco-awareness. But you can channel that anxiety into activism, and you can channel it into community.
I think what really drove me to XR was it's very inclusive. There's it's non-hierarchical structure.
When the April uprisings happened, I realized that actually this was not only an organization that had that was building momentum and had a method of doing things that could really work, but also it was doing it with values that I could get on board with, and more importantly, values that I think the general population can get on board with, beyond the people who are always going to rebel anyway. Their contribution is valid, but we need people from across all walks of life.
So we know that the climate crisis isn't brand new, and that it has been affecting millions of people across the global south for a long time. And yet, it's only in the last couple of years, it seems, that people in this country have really woken up to the urgency. So is this just down to XR? Can one group have all the answers? How did our panel think XR fits into the wider environmental movement?
It's not only down to XR. I would say absolutely not. It's definitely because we are just seeing the devastating effect of climate change on a global scale. You can agree to the science, be a scientist, be in touch with all of this, but if you don't really see it, some part of the general public won't believe it. The alarm has been raised and people are making more the links between, you know, extreme weather event and the fact that it comes from climate change. So that's just a fact. But I think what's really unique about XR is, and that's what someone said on the Vox, it's just that, yes, there is some values and principle that I think people can get on board with. The demand of tell the truth, which is, you know, for the government to work with the media to not water down the climate crisis and has this kind of information campaign. That's something that we do ourselves by delivering talks. And in those talks, one of the main points is you have to grieve basically the future. And there is this important emotional connect between you and what you're hearing. And once you've been able to grieve, then maybe you'll be able to act and act with hope. But you have to keep the spirits up, obviously, if you're doing some kind of activism like that.
There's been a steady build-up for years. It's gone in peaks and troughs. There's a real like spike in interest, I think, so around 2006, 7, 8, that sort of time. It dipped, and particularly after the Copenhagen talks failed. Then saw a bit of a rise again ahead of the Paris talks. I think what we're seeing this time is perhaps something which is much more sustained and a much greater shift in sort of public opinion. People are now far more accepting that the climate crisis is real, that it's happening now, we're right in the middle of it. And I think what XR have done is they've enabled a chunk of people, a big chunk of people in the UK, to want to get involved and want to get active, as those people you spoke to earlier sort of said. I think there's much more still to be done to make it a broader movement, an inclusive movement, and one that fundamentally shifts society and shifts politics to tackle the climate crisis.
So if XR have raised the heat in a public arena, has that helped your job at Friends of the Earth, where you're operating within legal structures to influence change, or hindered that?
I think anything that has shifted public opinion and like more firmly established the climate crisis as the most pressing issue of the day is a positive thing. I think for us, we've seen an awful lot more interest in how people can get involved and get involved in different ways. I think XR's model has been hugely successful, but going out and getting arrested isn't necessarily the thing that everyone wants to do. I think every movement has different parts to it, different styles to it, different elements to it. And for a movement to be effective, it takes up lots of different sections and lots of different tactics. And what I hope that over the coming years we see is this movement growing and a range of different tactics and approaches being taken, but all of them aimed at the same goal, which is tackling the climate crisis.
We asked people down at the protest sites whether they think XR's tactics are really going to work.
I mean, there's still a question mark whether it will work, but it has to be the right thing to do.
I think we're beyond the point of trying to raise awareness. So what we need now is for actual action to take place. We need people in Parliament to really listen and someone to take. We need a spearhead, I think, in Parliament to really take the leads and the reins.
Yes, it's going to work to some extent. Maybe raising public awareness so that the public can push back on government. Corporates seem to be paying attention as well. Maybe they're just concerned about image and such like, I don't know. But I think it is pushing the agenda, but not XR on its own, like in conjunction with so many other things across the world, especially scientific opinion.
You know, since April, we've noticed that the actual media is now giving the recognition and the prominence to climate crisis related stories.
With Extinction Rebellion, they have three very clear demands. Tell the truth, act now, and move beyond politics by creating a National Citizens Assembly. Those three clear demands mean that people understand why they're taking the action that they're taking.
The spirit of the people, you could never, never put it down. The spirit of the people will always rise up.
Usually in this podcast, we look back over past instances of social change. This episode is slightly different. We're looking at an ongoing movement with no single answer. So, I asked our panel whether they think XR's tactics will work and how optimistic they feel about the future of climate activism.
It depends how you measure success. If you measure success by those three demands, well, hasn't been achieved yet. But I think it's still achieved a great deal in kind of putting the subject forward, and the pressure is growing, it's really growing. And what's important is XR, we are here to raise to the attention that there is a problem in different sectors who are, you know, participating in ecocides, etc. Like today with the financial district action being taken place, we kind of highlighting the link between some financial sector and the financing of fossil fuel investments, etc. But we are not here to give the solutions. The solutions already exist and they have to be just implemented. It's a shift of investment and a conscience that have been raised on another level and then to be implemented by the government itself.
One of the things with XR, you said that you have the three aims. The number one is tell the truth. This is what I find really interesting, and this is one of my issues with XR. It was over a year ago, myself, Roger Hallam and others, we spoke at an event. And Roger Hallam spoke, and he was one of the most depressing people I ever come across. The earth was finished, we're going to be wiped out, slash our wrist, it's all over. That was his message, basically. It was like that. And I was like, yo, you can't be talking like this, you know? And I did a talk, and I spoke about 50 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King. Remember, this was 2018, and it was King died in 68. And I challenged the audience, saying, well, what have you been doing since 68, in the last 50 years, because those forces that King was fighting against have just increased. So what have the so-called activists been doing? And I was speaking about King's philosophy and King's tactics, and Roger Hallam didn't have a clue. And then he took a shift with the politics and the policies of XR. And I thought to myself, you wasn't talking old Martin Luther King talk till you heard me talking Martin Luther King, because King being an icon for the black community, we're going to honour King's legacy. And so I just found that really interesting. And then to know that we're talking about telling the truth, but we kind of tell the truth by omission, it makes me think, am I really hopeful, or is this just going to be co-opted because there'll be some funding given out and the funding won't be shared? You know, the land where the tar sands is indigenous land. The Amazon rainforest, which is burning, is indigenous land. In Nigeria, in the Delta region, where the people are suffering, it's indigenous land. So the indigenous people are suffering regardless, and I don't think XR are going to be able to help those people. That's my opinion. So I'm hopeful, but I'm also very cynical.
Alistair, are you optimistic about the future?
I'm generally a bit of an optimist, fairly sort of positive generally. I think in terms of the progress made, in terms of more people caring about the climate crisis, more people want to take action on the climate crisis, I think that's really positive. I think that positivity will evaporate if we don't continue to learn, to listen, and to change as a movement as well, and to get stronger that way, because as Rishi said, there's a risk we just get co-opted along the way, and that the false starts that we've had in the past continue, and we can't afford to have a false start this time.
Mm. And very finally, is there anything that you guys feel you've learned from XR about what it means to be a campaigner and how social change is happening?
In terms of like my involvement, I've obviously learned a huge amount of skills about campaigning. Would it be public speaking, outreaching, all of those things that I don't get to do on my day-to-day job. So there is some like personal skills to be taken, but in terms of the broader movement of campaigning, I do really think that having very clear demand is one of those key factors that makes XR successful, and therefore I'm thinking a campaign successful. We can think of the Occupy movement, which was, you know, successful in occupying, but then didn't have maybe a very clear demand of what they wanted, and the movement then kind of crumbled after that. So I think XR is a bit different with that regard.
I would say, what has XR brought to the table? They've brought the philosophy of non-violent mass civil disobedience back onto the agenda, and I have to salute them for that. So please don't get the wrong idea. I'm not anti-XR. I'm like, you know what, you do what you do. You know, it's all cool. We've been taking knocks and licks upside our head in my community, you know, since 19 whenever. You know, welcome to the club. And also, what I would say that XR, what they have done is that they've created a brand in the world. I don't want to sound cynical, but they've created a successful brand, and you know, you've got the logo and you see it and it signifies something. And I think that's in an age of branding, it's good that you got a brand.
Yeah,
I do actually like XR. I'm not anti-XR. Okay?
I think for me, it's a reminder about the importance of clarity and consistency of a really good message that there is a climate emergency, that there's a climate crisis. Repeating that time and time again, because that's really landed, I think, and that's really helped shift things in the last 12 months.
Brilliant. Thank you all so much. Social change is dynamic. It needs different actors working in different ways. It's clear from talking to Chloe, Rashid and Alistair that tackling the climate crisis is no exception. Extinction Rebellion is just one part of the movement. In a short space of time, it has tapped into people's collective power and brought them together around the tactics of non-violent civil disobedience. But as we look to the future of climate activism, we must also consider who XR is reaching and who it is really for. You've been listening to the Social Power podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. To listen to other episodes on a range of issues, from the Irish abortion referendum to fossil fuel divestment, head to our website, www.smk.org.uk.